live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty. This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, a Narrowsburg bar is ordered shut down, a rooftop deck is at the center of it all, and now allegations of a fraudulent report. We'll get the latest from River Reporter's Liam Mayo about Bar Veloce. From space rocks that may hold the recipe for life, to a comet visiting from another star system, to breakthrough research on repairing spinal cord injuries, science is making some big headlines this week, and our resident science guy Joe Johnson is here to tell us more. And what does it take to join the Catskill 3500 Club? Brett Berry from CatsCast finds out when he goes on a hike with the club and learns that Hunter Mountain is more than just a peak. It's part of a hiking tradition. That's all coming up. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Israel says it has carried out a strike in the capital of Qatar. It targeted senior Hamas leaders. There is no immediate confirmation of casualties. NPR's Daniel Estrin has more from Tel Aviv.
This is the first time Israel has carried out a strike in Doha. It marks an escalation in Israel's war against Hamas. Israel's military says the Hamas leaders targeted were directly responsible for Hamas's October 7th, 2023 attack on Israel and have since been, quote, orchestrating and managing the war with Israel. It came as Hamas took claim for a shooting attack in Jerusalem yesterday that killed six Israelis. Qatar called the strike a cowardly attack on residential buildings housing Hamas political leaders. Qatar has hosted Hamas political leaders for years in coordination with the U.S. to establish lines of communication, according to a Qatari official who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss the sensitive issue. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The United Nations Secretary General says the world is spending far more on waging war than in building peace. The UN is out with a report today that says global military spending reached a record $2.7 trillion last year. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling on the world to rebalance its military spending and refocus on the UN's goals to fight poverty, increase health care and education. More than 100 countries have increased their military budgets to hit a global record in 2024. The $2.7 trillion amounts to $334 for every person on the planet, the report says. And it's the size of the entire gross domestic product for all African countries. Guterres says, quote, excessive military spending does not guarantee peace. Instead, it can fuel arms races and deepen mistrust among countries. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
The U.S. Supreme Court has told the Trump administration it will allow federal immigration agents to resume widespread random sweeps in the Los Angeles area. Opponents say agents can now stop people, even American citizens, who look Latino, speak a different language, or work in low-wage jobs. Opponents have vowed to fight. Separately, President Trump is asking the Supreme Court to take up another issue, his tariffs. NPR's Danielle Kurtz-Leben says lower courts have ruled these tariffs are illegal.
Trump imposed those using emergency powers. It's a law called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. A federal trade court and then a federal appeals court have said that no, these tariffs are not lawful under that act. So now the White House has asked the Supreme Court to weigh in on whether these tariffs should be allowed to remain in place.
NPR's Danielle Kurtz-Leben reporting. You're listening to NPR. In Texas, a law that allowed students without legal status to pay in-state tuition ended over the summer. Thousands of affected students must now pay in-state tuition, no matter how long they have lived in Texas. From member station KUT, Greta Diaz-Gonzalez-Vasquez has more.
After the Texas Dream Act was repealed, tuition for students without legal status increased, even tripling in some cases. Fernanda, a student at UT Austin who asked that we only use her first name for fear of being deported, was one of the students who said they couldn't afford to go back to school for the fall semester.
The sense of like hopelessness really took over, something that I, even with everything going on before, I'd never felt this way. And so that was probably the biggest heartbreak.
The American Immigration Council estimates the end of the Texas Dream Act will have economic impacts beyond immigrant families, with the state potentially losing more than $460 million each year. I'm Greta Diaz Gonzalez Vázquez in Austin, Texas.
The elusive street artist Banksy has claimed responsibility for a new mural that appeared this week on the side of a judicial building in London. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports the mural was quickly covered with black plastic, and a judge ruled it will be removed because of rules about listed buildings.
The mural is on the outer wall of London's Royal Courts of Justice. It depicts a judge in a traditional wig and robe using a gavel to beat a protester. There's no reference to any particular incident, but it comes amid free speech concerns as police arrest hundreds of protesters across the country weekly for expressing support for a banned pro-Palestinian group.
NPR's Lauren Freyer reporting. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Bar Veloce in Narrowsburg, New York, is once again facing code enforcement issues. The bar has been ordered closed after allegations that a fraudulent engineering report was submitted as part of its application for retroactive approval of its rooftop deck. It's the latest in a string of disputes between the business and the town. Joining us live to talk about the latest developments is Liam Mayo of the River Reporter, who's been covering the story. Liam, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Can you summarize what led to Bar Veloce's order of closure by the town of Tustin?
Yeah. So as you said, there's a need for Bar Veloce to get retroactive approval for its rooftop bar. This goes back to around 4 years ago when Bar Veloce was looking to come into Narrowsburg. They got approval from the planning board to retrofit the first floor of the Narrowsburg Motors car dealership and auto repair shop into like this upscale bar. However, they did not get planning board approval for the roof. They did end up constructing a rooftop bar, but they never got the permit for that. And it was the planning board's understanding back then, and is still the understanding now, that if anyone is to like go up there, if they are to open the rooftop bar for business, they would need to go back to the planning board for a permit. So that's what they've been doing this year, looking to get that retroactive permit for that rooftop bar. But in the process of doing so, one of the things they submitted was a engineering report validating that the rooftop bar is structurally sound. According to the documents submitted, the report is allegedly... the report says that it is the report from a professional engineer named James Anderson. And in this report, this so quote-unquote James Anderson is saying that I, as a professional engineer, verify that this rooftop bar is structurally sound. So he's saying that according to his judgment as an engineer, the roof is safe and capable of holding people. So it's a fairly important document to be legit. So that was submitted, and after it was submitted, there's a neighboring business, Narrowsburg Union, that has been sort of questioning the approvals for this business all the way through, and they started questioning some of the details of that report. According to the Narrowsburg Union, there are some fairly obvious mistakes in it. One of the details they pointed out was the report cites the New York State Building Code of 2022 when there isn't a 2022 building code. There's a 2020 and a 2024, but not a 22. So that raised a couple of red flags with the business, and they reached out to the engineer to ask for more details on the report. When they did reach the engineer wrote back to them and wrote back to the town saying that he did not write this report. We have the email he sent to the town, and just to quote a little bit from it, quote, by copy of this email, I am writing to tell all parties that the letter/report reportedly authored by me is in fact fraudulent and not authored by me. I am writing to inform you that I/we take no responsibility for the determination of adequacy of the structure whatsoever, and that whoever produced this letter report using my name and license number did so without my permission or knowledge. So according to the engineer whose name is on the report, he did not write this report and he does not make any determination that the building is structurally sound. He wasn't involved at all in this project.
No. Lots to unpack there. Let me just stop for a second. Lots to unpack. There's a lot of information there. So I just want to be clear again. Like when the bar first opened in 2023, and this was after some other disputes with the Narrowsburg Union, I guess, they were only approved to renovate and use the ground floor of what had been the full Narrowsburg Motors building. The bar is built atop Narrowsburg Motors, a used auto sales and repair establishment.
Yes. However, they had already built the rooftop bar like 2 years before that. They had just never gotten permission for
it. And then, you know, has there been an effort from the town to work with them to say, hey, we do need you to get this new application, and giving them, you know, room to do that?
Yeah. I mean, what they've been doing this year is that process. It's like after they built the bar or the rooftop bar without permission, the project or the process for repairing that was to go back to the town and get kind of a new permit for that construction. And as for why it's happening now and not 3 years ago or when it was originally brought up in 2021, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But that was always the understanding that if they were to open the rooftop bar, they would have to go back and get a permit from the town.
And we're going through this process. There was this engineering report. It turns out that there were irregularities in the report and fraudulent, I guess. How did these irregularities first come to light?
Yeah, the irregularities came to light through this neighboring business, the Narrowsburg Union, questioning it. The Narrowsburg Union is right across the road from Bar Veloce, and it has had an issue with Bar Veloce sort of from the beginning due to parking, among other things. Bar Veloce doesn't really have a ton of parking on site. It has very, very few parking spaces. So when it was originally approved, it needed to get variances for people to park in other nearby lots. The Narrowsburg Union has a fairly large parking lot and parking spaces sort of around it. However, it considers those parking spaces its own and does not want them open to general members of the public. So it had
Liam, are you still there? Oh, it looks like we lost Liam there.
Union.
You just dropped out for a second there. Sorry. You're back.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
No, it's okay. You were talking about how the parking spaces around the union and the lack of parking and how they're trying to maintain those for their business. Let me get back to this fraudulent report for a second. Are there any indications of who may have created this report?
Not as of this time, no. That's something that I think will continue to emerge as for development.
Yeah.
We don't have sort of statements as of yet from the...
Liam, we're having a little bit of problem with your line there. I don't know if you're moving or not, but just try if you can stay still. It seems like there's some interference. Can you hear us okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, we can. There's just some interference there on that line. Let's take a quick break, and we'll try to reset here, and we'll be back with more from Liam Mayo of The River Reporter. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Celebrate 35 years of Radio Catskill at the Lou Beach Community House Summer Jubilee. Join us this Saturday from 5 to 8 p.m. for live music from Calla Sun and Lolly and the Pops and a DJ set by the Mixtapes' Jason Dugan, plus cold beer from Catskill Brewery. Tickets are $25 and proceeds benefit Radio Catskill. More information at wjffradio.org. The Lou Beach Community House Summer Jubilee, a project of the Beaverkill Valley Land Trust.
With federal funding for public media eliminated, listeners all over this country are stepping up to support public radio. Hi, I'm Elsa Chang from All Things Considered.
And I'm Aisha Roscoe from Weekend Edition. We're here to share a little of what people are saying. Kyle in Brooklyn says, I'm skipping two lattes a month to keep Steve Inskeep in my ear each morning. We see you and thank you, Kyle.
Farouk in El Paso, Texas says, public radio is one of the key bloodlines of this country, keeping communities connected. Thank you, Farouk.
And Diane in Juneau, Alaska says, I'm so sorry this day has come. You have my support as long as I am able. Thanks, Diane.
If you have already made your gift to the station, or if you're a sustaining donor, seriously, thank you.
If not, please join the movement to protect public radio today and tell us why you're stepping up.
Here's how to donate, and thanks.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We're talking to Liam Mayo of the River Reporter, and I think we have you back on the line, Liam.
Testing, testing.
There you go. Talking about two of the big things in the area that are of concern, cell service and parking. So let's talk a little bit more about what's going on in the town of Tustin with the Bar Veloce being ordered to close by the town. We were talking about this fraudulent engineering report. I think you were trying to explain about indications of who may have created that fraudulent report, or if there are any indications of how that came to be.
Yeah, we don't have any indications as of this moment. It's a very developing situation. But I did want to sort of more directly respond to a question you'd asked about how this came to light, because I was sort of getting at that in a very roundabout way. But directly, Narrowsburg Union, this neighboring business, has questioned every single point of Bar Veloce's approval process and has checked Bar Veloce's math at every stage. So it checking this particular engineering report was just the thing it does to every document that Bar Veloce submits. And it happens to, in this case, catch the fact that allegedly this report was not authored by the person who it purports to be authored by.
How did the town of Tustin respond once they received the engineer's statement about not being involved in that report?
Yeah. So the town of Tustin received this, we believe, on Tuesday, August 26th, so 2 weeks ago. The following day, they held an emergency town hall and then an emergency town board meeting in the town hall. And the day after, they had the town's code enforcement officer revoke the business's certificate of occupancy, essentially closing it until it gets its violations redressed.
And are there then now some ongoing procedures or legal actions that the town's taking following revelations of this report?
Yeah, I'm not sure where it stands before the planning board, which I think is going to be the agency that addresses a lot of these complaints. We know, or town supervisor Ben Johnson has said that the Narrowsburg Union filed an Article 76 challenge against the town in this case, which led to the emergency town board meeting, and an Article 78 is basically something you can file to challenge a decision taken by a municipal government or agency in the state of New York. And actually, Narrowsburg Union has previously filed, if I'm remembering correctly, an Article 78 challenging earlier decisions from the town. So it's that kind of legal proceeding that, according to town supervisor Ben Johnson, was the immediate cause for the revocation of the certificate of occupancy.
And we should also note there's an interesting wrinkle here in terms of relationships. The town supervisor, Ben Johnson, works for Narrowsburg Motors, where the bar is on top of, and is married to its owner.
Yes, and that is a relationship that I think the Narrowsburg Union has also questioned whether there was any sort of preferential treatment to Bar Veloce because of that relationship. That's not something we've been able to find, but that's something that has been questioned previously.
So nevertheless, the town of Tustin code enforcement officer Jim Crowley rescinded the certificate of occupancy and closed Bar Veloce. Is that correct? And so have you heard back from either the town supervisor, anyone from Bar Veloce, Narrowsburg Union, all the folks involved in this issue?
Yeah, we heard from the town supervisor just about that emergency town meeting. But aside from that, the town supervisor, as well as parties on both sides, have declined opportunities to comment. Just seeing this as a situation that will be involved in litigation and not really wanting to speak about it while that is ongoing.
And we're talking about how parking is part of this whole issue in some ways. There's a parking crunch in Narrowsburg with ongoing space issues because they've Well, they've grown a lot, and that's a big problem. Explain to folks who may not have been to Narrowsburg what the issue is.
Yeah, so this is comes out of a story that a reporter, Carla Guzman, was working on sort of independently of all of the stuff happening with Bartolomé. But it syncs up really nicely because one of the reasons business relations are tense in Narrowsburg is a close tightness of space. There's the quote-unquote downtown in Narrowsburg is kind of, just due to the geography of the place, fairly restrained to just a very few couple of streets. And right now, there is limited public parking available in that area. There's parking kind of along Main Street. There is a town-owned lot just off of Main Street. And then there's another, like, smaller lot near the town's library. But especially on really busy weekends in the summer when Narrowsburg gets a lot of tourism traffic, those lots and that Main Street parking space all get very, very filled up. And this is something that the Narrowsburg Union has been questioning, not just with Bartolomé, but with sort of the town as a whole for the past couple of years. They've been questioning whether there is enough parking in town and whether the town needs to do a parking survey to identify its needs. And over the past couple of years, there has been a lot of formerly disused businesses kind of springing back into life. There was a large-scale, like, furniture shop on Main Street that got renovated into a series of, like, boutiques. There's a what was formerly used as a bank building that has been renovated as a brewery. So, and there are still kind of more buildings around town that lay vacant or underused that could continue to be developed. So there's been this tightness of parking going back a couple of years, and over those couple of years, the number of businesses using that parking and bringing people into the town has only grown. So that's kind of where that tension is coming in, and that's why some of these disputes between businesses, as in the case with Narrowsburg Union and Bartolomé, can potentially be a little tenser than they would be in another town where this is less of an issue.
And this is what you want if you're a small town business owner or folks who live in that town. You want to see people coming to the town. You want to see vibrant businesses. But it's an issue. And in fact, it's an issue that's not new. It's a longstanding issue for the town.
Oh, yeah. Like you said, it's a nice problem to have. And it's just something that businesses and buildings will, and the town will have to sort of continue to think about. We've looked into this study from the American Planning Association, which found that poor management of curb space costs cities billions each year and can create congestion and safety issues. Now, Narrowsburg, New York is not a silly city bringing in billions of dollars of revenue each year, but the same things apply, where if you poorly manage your parking space, that could impact the future development of the community in the area. And just real quick, I will mention, just for transparency's sake, that the River Reporter's offices are just off of downtown Main, Narrowsburg. Right. So this is a parking issue that I am intimately familiar with.
Very familiar with. You also spoke to the town supervisor about this. And what are they saying about balancing the need to reduce, you know, conflict between residents and businesses and, you know, promoting growth, maintaining quality of life?
Yeah. So we spoke to a bunch of people around town, and a lot of them said this wasn't really an issue right now, or that we were speaking to them about the right this week, the lot is getting sort of, or the public-owned lot is getting resurfaced, so it's not available for parking. A lot of business owners said that isn't going to really be an issue for them. When we spoke to the town supervisor, he pointed out the fact that there is this secondary town-owned lot by the library that a lot of people don't park in because it's a little bit of a walk from Main Street, so it's not sort of the first thing people think of when they're parking downtown. By a little bit of a walk, I mean maybe 2 or 3 minutes, but it's still, like, is something people don't think about to park in as much. He also mentioned that enforcement for Tustin is fairly limited. Tustin doesn't have, like, local constables or any kind of, like, parking enforcement people. So if there are issues with people parking in unsafe areas or on streets where they're not supposed to, that sort of goes up to the sheriff's office or the state to do that enforcement, which can, you know, not necessarily always be relied on.
That's Leah Mayo, news editor for the River Reporter, covering the town there and doing some great work. And if you see him circling looking for a space, let him have it. He's doing great work. He needs to get to work. Leah Mayo, thank you so much. You can read more about his reporting and all the great reporting from the team at riverreporter.com. Thanks, Liam.
Thank you for having me.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, we've got science stories from Joe Johnson, life's ingredients, strange interstellar chemistry, and spinal cord repair. That's coming up. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill.
I'm Mimi Bradley, Radio Catskill's development manager, reminding you that a great way to keep public radio here in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania is by becoming a sound supporter. Sound supporters give small amounts, $20, $30, $50 a month or more, that add up to a big help. Plus, sound supporters get special thank yous, like drawings for tickets to events in our community throughout the year. Become a sound supporter. Go to WJFFradio.org.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. This week on Science Stories with Joe Johnson, he's spanning the cosmos, the insect world, and the frontiers of medicine. The asteroid Bennu is yielding secrets about the building blocks of life after NASA's sample return mission brought home more than 4 ounces of space dust and rock. Joe also looks at the third interstellar comet ever detected, now sprouting a tail and revealing strange chemistry not seen in our solar system. And scientists at the University of Minnesota are reporting a breakthrough in spinal cord repair using 3D printed scaffolds and stem cells, restoring function in injured rats and offering new hope for people with paralysis. Here's Joe speaking with our own Jason Dole.
Well, we got three stories this week. The first one is a space story. I usually try to have a space story because it's something I'm really interested in. But this is kind of space and chemistry together. The first part of this is all about the asteroid Bennu. Now, back in 2016, NASA launched the OSIRIS-REx mission, which is this really long acronym I'm not going to repeat, to near-Earth asteroid Bennu to sample it and return the sample to Earth. It made contact with the asteroid in 2020. And in September of 2023, about 2 years ago, returned about 121 grams or about a little over 4 ounces of rocks and dust. Now, it's taken 2 years to analyze this because of the absolute painstaking, complex, careful way that these samples, think how precious these samples are, they have to be handled and analyzed. It's involved over 200 scientists from the U.S., Japan, France, Germany, and the U.K., and they've used some really powerful technology to analyze the sample. The really thing I think they're thinking about here, though, is the future, because about 70% of the sample has been preserved for future analysis, thinking that perhaps they'll figure out another way to look at it in the future. But what does Bennu have? Well, it has a lot of organic materials, about 14 out of 20 amino acids and all 5 nucleobases. It also has ammonia, which is a really important nitrogen source for organic reactions. It's got a lot of minerals and chemical compounds, and this is the shocking part, that can only form in liquid water. And so it has these class of minerals called evaporites, which are things like carbonates, sulfates, and phosphates. Now, on Earth, they only form in dry lake beds. So this was a real surprise. Now, basically, I would call this life soup, you know, because much of the stuff you need to form life in terms of the organic stuff and the minerals is in this asteroid, very similar to Earth's early conditions. Now, the analysis suggests that Bennu is a fragment of a primitive ocean world. Now, whether it's a planet or a moon, obviously it's been broken up, probably from the outer colder regions of the solar system, because there's no evidence of any strong heating for any of the minerals. We can tell, like, what temperature a mineral forms at, and these all formed at relatively cool temperatures. You know, was this how the raw materials of Earth, or of life on Earth, were delivered to the Earth? We don't know. So it's some real, very, very cool chemistry going on here.
Yeah, and if you're talking about, like, asteroids, which are pretty much accepted to be remnants of the early mm-hmm. solar system mm-hmm. and planetoids that may have been forming. And then something happened to them, and then you have evidence that there once was water on that. So I like it they put out there this might have been from a watery world of yeah. one size or another, because that's what the anecdotal evidence points to. And you said it took them a couple of years to get to these samples. Of course, you know, the sample container was stuck in the beginning. I remember those headlines. Yeah, that was probably part of the delay, too.
The door was jammed because they actually grabbed more than they thought they were going to get. And so what they did is they very quickly stowed it inside the spacecraft. There was a separate chamber to stow the whole thing before more could escape, because they think they lost some of it. But they still got about twice as much as they had originally planned to get. So all in all, a success.
Well, you know, so these are the ways to sample and test bodies from within our own solar system. Mm-hmm. How might we go about it if there was a body from perhaps outside of the solar system?
Well, there just happens to be one right now, and that's called 3I Atlas. Now, this was discovered on July 1st. It's the third interstellar object detected. That's the 3I part. Presumably from a distant star system and just passing through our system. We can tell that because of the shape of its curve, but it's passing through at about 130,000 miles per hour. The big news this week for 3I Atlas is that it's growing a tail as the ice, you know, presumably it has a lot of ice. The ice is subliming and it's going directly from a solid into a gas. And because it's a gas and because there is sunlight hitting it, we can do a spectrographic analysis and we can tell what it is. And the chemistry is really not typical of native comets, you know, comets from our solar system. It's showing a lot of carbon dioxide, a lot more carbon dioxide than normal comets from our solar system do, but not a lot of water. Almost no carbon monoxide, once again, very different from solar system comets. And here's the weird part, nickel, but no iron. Now, nickel and iron are usually formed together because they're, you know, right next to each other, I believe, on the periodic table, or very close to each other. And so their conditions that form them are much the same. And so to see nickel but no iron, that's a little strange.
You know, so since it's growing in a tail, is it accurate to call 3I Atlas a comet? I don't often
yes.
hear people calling it a comet.
Yeah,
is
yeah,
that
yeah.
what this is now?
It is a comet, yeah, kind of officially. They thought it was a comet at first, just because of the spectrum they could get off the surface of it. Now it's kind of officially more like a comet because it is growing a tail.
And just to be clear, this is a comet that is not from where just about any other comet you've
right.
ever heard of in your life
right,
has
right.
come from.
Yeah. Most of the comets come from the Oort cloud, you know, out beyond the orbit of Pluto, where there's these large icy bodies, and occasionally one will fall in towards the sun, forming a comet. You know, it'll grow a tail as it gets closer and closer to the sun and gets heated up. So, this is a different critter.
Okay, wow. Thanks for giving us that double dose of space update. Step into my parlor, said the spider to the firefly, because I got some work for you.
Yeah.
Like, what's this about?
There's two stories this week, two separate papers, one from about a year ago and one from just very recently. Paper number one, scientists at Tsinghua University in China noticed that sheet web spiders, and those are spiders like wolf spiders around here. You walk out on your lawn in the morning and you see the web covered with dew. That's a sheet web spider. They built their net webs really close to the ground, and they saw that they were accumulating fireflies because the spider didn't attack and consume them like other prey. Normally when a spider, you know, catches something in its web, it attacks it and consumes it. You know, it wraps it up in silk and injects it with venom. Now, they stayed alive while stuck in the web, and they continued to make light flashes. When they stopped, the spider ate them. And so the scientists thought, well, maybe he's keeping them alive. Maybe the spiders are keeping them alive as bait. And you could ask the spider, but you're not going to get much of an answer from the
yeah.
spider. So they set up an experiment. They put small LEDs with the same spectrum as the fireflies in some spider webs and left other webs without LEDs as a control. They set up cameras and videotaped the results. And what they found is that the webs with the LEDs, with the fake fireflies, got about three times more prey than those without. So it kind of looks like they're keeping them as bait for other insects.
Yeah, and it can't just be about taste because they eventually do eat them when they stop blinking.
Right, so, they eventually do consume them. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's interesting. But you say there's another paper on a similar subject.
And this is even stranger. This is from an international team of scientists studying orb spiders. And those are the spiders that have the polygonal webs that you see around here. I taught my children all about them when they were young. Now, the species of male fireflies that they're catching produce different signals. The male fireflies produce this complex pattern of rapid flashes to attract females. You know, the males are being all flashy, trying to attract the ladies. The female fireflies only produce a single flash at intervals. Now, when the spider catches a male firefly in its web, it immediately, you know, runs over to it, it bites it with venom, and then it wraps it partially in silk. And what they found is that the venom has an effect on the male firefly. Every time it bites it, it makes a single flash. And so it actually converts the male firefly to produce male-attracting flashes and gets more males and bites them and makes them look like females and then bites more males and just goes on until it has a whole bunch of attractive fireflies.
My goodness, that's nuts. That's something else. And to think that, like, we've been looking at spiders and fireflies for how long, and we're just starting to figure this out.
Yeah, I never thought of a relationship there between them, but that's a pretty interesting experiments that they've been doing. And our last story, is about spinal cord repair. This is from an August 26th article in Advanced Healthcare Materials. It's all about a team from the University of Minnesota. Now, first of all, a little background. About 300,000 people in the U.S. alone suffer from spinal cord injuries and paralysis. Now, most tissues like bones and muscles can heal and regrow after an injury, but nerve tissue does not regenerate. And so what these medical scientists did was a unique approach. They 3D printed a framework, and this is about 1.8 millimeters in size. It's not very big. They printed this framework from silicone that they call an organoid scaffold with microscopic channels running through it. They then filled those channels with, this is a quote from the paper, specific neural progenitor cells, which are derived from human adult stem cells. These have the capacity to differentiate into specific types of cells. And what the channels do is it actually kind of directed the growth of these stem cells. They then took this scaffold, transplanted it into rats that had severed spinal cords, and let it, let the heal. And what they found is that the stem cells eventually would differentiate into neurons and extend themselves in both directions and establish connections with the rats' existing neural pathways. This is amazing stuff. And they say that it led to, and this I'm quoting again here, significant functional recovery in the rats.
So this sounds to be huge. Out of all the stories that you've gone over today, this sounds to be the most momentous
one. This is a biggie, This is, of course, just a first step. They said that it's a beginning step and much more work is going to be needed here. But the fact that it could help people that have suffered these spinal cord injuries, the fact that it could potentially help them to regenerate their spinal cord is, to me, amazing.
What's the next thing to watch for or listen for along lines of this story? This is just the first step. What will you be keeping an eye out for?
I'll be keeping an eye out for the fact that it can regenerate different types of neurons. You have motor neurons, which run muscles and stuff, but you also have sensory neurons. And so can they regenerate both of those types? Can they integrate this fully back into the rat's spinal cord so that it regains full function? If they can do that, then the next trials, they'll move up to different animals and eventually, hopefully, human trials.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for bringing these major events in the world of science that may well have major impacts on our lives. This is always interesting, and thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thanks to Joe and Jason. We'll take a break, and when we come back, Brett Berry of Cats Cast is joining the journey, a Catskill 3500 Club hike. We'll hear about it next. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear the exotic sounds of Martin Denny and vibraphonist Jimmy Namaro. Plus, there's a new album by the Waitiki Seven. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7 here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. In the latest episode of Cats Cast, the Catskills podcast, Brett Berry laces up his boots and heads into the high peaks with Michael Bongar, longtime member and current president of the Catskill 3500 Club. Their destination, Southwest Hunter Mountain, one of the club's required summits. Here to tell us more is Brett Berry. Brett, good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
You are not just sitting there talking to somebody on the phone. You're out there in the elements hiking Hunter Mountain.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fun way to tell a story, isn't it?
Absolutely, and thanks for hiking so we don't have to. What is the tell us a little bit more about the Catskill 3500 Club.
This is probably the most prominent hiking club in the area, and it's been around since 1962. And the goal is to hike all of the mountains that exceed 3,500 feet in elevation. And so at this point, there's 32 peaks on the list, and you check them off. There's no time limit, and about a third of them are trailless. Doesn't mean that there's no trails at all, but there's no marked trails. So map and compass and now apps are really helpful to just make sure you're heading in the right direction.
And to earn membership, as you said, you have to climb those peaks, and you have to repeat four of them in the winter?
Exactly. There's four particular peaks to repeat between December and March to encourage winter skills, which I don't know if I'm looking forward to that, but I guess I got to do it. So, get those snowshoes out. I think we have a little time, though.
You have a little time. You got to earn that badge. All right, let's listen to your hike with Michael Bongar, the current president of the Catskill 3500 Club. Thanks so much, Brett.
Thank you, Tim.
So I lead one hike a month for the club, generally. And my hikes are advertised as slow but steady. There are other hike leaders who
zippity-doo-dah
rock and roll, like you, I can tell already.
Yeah, this is her pace in life.
Yeah.
CatsCast recently set out with Michael Bongar, president of the storied 3500 Club, whose members hike a list of Catskills peaks exceeding 3,500 feet. We were joined by my friend Kathleen, whose goals usually involve speed, but for the most part, she tempered her pace to match our small group rhythm as we ascended one of the so-called trailless peaks on the 3,500 Club list, Southwest Hunter, also known as Levitt Peak. Michael joked that the cool hikers don't bother with checklists.
The really cool people don't keep track. They just hike. But
I don't know if he really believes that. And there's much to be said about the framework of a hiking challenge. I, for one, enjoy the satisfaction of checking off a list. And this particular list is a great way to experience the Catskills. As of July 2025, the Catskill 3500 Club boasts 4,718 members. That's 4,718 people who climbed every peak on the list and kept a record of it. Michael Bongar is member number 2173. And I hope to snag a number of my own within the next few years. In fact, despite years of hiking in the Catskills, I'd consider today's hike with Michael and Kathleen the first official hike toward my own 3500 Club membership. And I couldn't have asked for a better guide to help kick off the challenge.
Hi, I'm Michael Bongar, and we are hiking up to Southwest Hunter from the end of Spruceton Road. We're going to, we're on an old road now. In fact, we're going to see some colonial rock piles to the left. We're going to the waterfall, and then we're going to hit Devil's Path and hike up towards Devil's Acre lean-to, and then down an old railroad grade to Southwest Hunter.
And Southwest Hunter is one of the peaks you have to climb to gain membership into the 3500 Club.
Right, the Catskill 3500 Club, which was founded in 1962 and was originally based on a list compiled by the Smileys.
Same Smileys from Mohonk?
The same. In fact, Virginia Smiley created the logo for the Catskill 3500 Club. But their list was about the habitat of the Bicknell's thrush. They were birders. And above 3,500 feet in the boreal forest, the first spruce forest, is where the where they fledge, like in June every year.
So 3,500 is not arbitrary. That number was chosen for the best chances of spotting this bird.
Correct. And subsequently, this mountain that we're going to was added to the list. It wasn't originally on it. Southwest Hunter, which is also called Levitt Peak, named after the couple who first did the 3500 challenge, the Levitts.
That's William and Eleanor Levitt, club members 1 and 2 on the list.
And so at this point, 33 peaks need to be hiked in order to gain membership in the club.
Yeah, you want me to name them?
No, you don't have to. But you can join as an aspirant before completing the challenge?
Right.
Do you consider it a challenge?
It is a challenge, and that's the beauty. You know, it's really a great accomplishment for people. I love celebrating that accomplishment. That's historically what the club's all about. So 33. And the brilliant thing that the creators of the club did was they said, plus, you've got to hike 4 of them again in the winter. And people say, no, not the winter. And I may have even been guilty of that. The winter, even though I'd hiked my whole life and I did have winter camping and hiking, it's brilliant because it allowed me, for instance, to get skills where I could go out west and hike 14,000 foot peaks.
Does the club care how you ascend, from which side or by which trail?
No. And there are always multiple ways. Interestingly, this mountain, Southwest Hunter, Levitt Peak, was historically the one where people would have to come back 2 and 3 times. Because as you will see in about 90 minutes, hopefully, it's a very dense fir spruce forest. And, you know, we didn't have the internet. Now you just go on, you see, okay, there's an old railroad grade. Just go down that and then shoot up. Before that, people would go all different directions and routes. It used to be that we encouraged people to take different routes to the summits. Mm-hmm. Now, because of usage, we think it's great to limit it to a single path.
Established and paths.
Yeah. And then we're right in the process of that happening with the DEC.
About a third of the Catskill peaks over 3,500 feet are trailless, and traditionally hikers would bushwhack with map and compass, finding their way to the summit and signing in at a 3,500 club canister attached to a tree. These days, with GPS apps and increased usage, so-called herd paths have developed, and those formerly trailless peaks are now crisscrossed by a panoply of paths that can have a negative impact on the environment. Think ground nesting birds and rare plants. And also on hikers, who might blindly follow what looks like an established path to some dead end on the wrong side of the mountain.
To remedy this, the Department of Environmental Conservation just released a draft visitor use management plan for formerly trailless Catskill High Peaks, with an eye toward official, sustainable trails. The department is accepting public comment on the proposal until September 15th. Here's Michael with more on that topic.
When I first did these, it wasn't that long ago, truly you bushwhacked. You had to reconnoiter the ground on your own using a map and compass. But over the years, and especially starting around the time of the pandemic, so many people were doing it that herd paths developed. The DEC released and completed their study, and it sounds like in the Catskills, there may be trail markers involved.
How does the club feel about that?
Club supports the DEC 100%.
Do you think the DEC will adopt mostly along the existing herd paths?
Some of them are perfect. They're along ridges, but some that go up a mountain are not sustainable and will harm the mountain, erode it. So it's a lot of work, and I'm hoping the club will be able to help the DEC. DEC has wonderful scientists. I believe that they're balancing between public usage and environmental degradation. I think it's going to be a really happy compromise. That's me speaking. The board of the 3500 Club has to develop their response. But it's going to be something like that.
Is there some thread that ties everyone together, a type of person who wants to sign up to be a member of this club?
Yes, absolutely. Love of nature, respect of nature, wish to do an esoteric accomplishment. What appealed to me when I decided to do it, it's like, wow, I will really get to know these mountains in a different way, knowing where all the trailheads are, going through all the communities to those trailheads. You see, there are certain features that repeat on every mountain, on many different mountains, and then there are features that are only in one place.
So the club, if nothing else, gives you a framework to get you to all these different peaks that you might otherwise skip if you were just kind of hiking scattershot.
Yeah, you really get to know the land, the earth, the flora and fauna.
Michael, once you completed the 3500 club requirements and the winter 3500 club requirements, it's not like you're not still drawn to the trails, right? So
yeah.
There's a sense of accomplishment, but then how do you choose? How have you chosen once those requirements were met? Which ones do you go back to? Is it ones that you enjoy, or do you still try to diversify?
I try to diversify, and I try to gauge it towards what I think an aspirant's going to want to do. You know, I love meeting aspirants. I love meeting people that have never done one before. I vet people pretty clearly.
And I made the cut.
You made it.
Yeah.
And I got to.
And Kathleen made the cut.
Kathleen, last minute. So I don't do the marathons. I try to do things that normal people would enjoy. And then learning about the people you're hiking with.
Michael, do you have a favorite trail in the Catskills?
You know what I love is being in the boreal forest. It's always a good 10 degrees colder than down in the valley. And it's a fir spruce forest. And that's what we have here when we're on top. And just the smell, the peacefulness, it's fantastic.
Getting ever closer to the summit of Southwest Hunter, I asked Michael to describe that canister we'd be looking for.
So a canister, I think they were originally like coffee cans. Right now it's a PVC tube with a lid, a very tight fitting lid. And there's a baggie inside of it with a little notebook. At the summit of the Bushwhack, formerly Trailless Peaks, canisters are have been maintained by Jim Boughton for 17 years. And he now has a very able assistant, Mike Sudi. And those two gentlemen are hiking these mountains on a regular enough basis to make sure that the notebooks are refreshed.
And so that is proof that you've made it to that Trailless Peak. And it also, I imagine, is confirmation to the hiker that you've made it to the right place.
Yeah. Historically, before GPS, there were people, this in particular, Southwest Hunter, I have friends that had to come back three times because it was very difficult. Now, the DEC uses that information to gauge usage, by the way. They used to be gray. A couple years ago, we started to paint them orange. Trouble is the orange peels off a little bit, so they have to be refreshed and repainted.
Since this was a new peak for Kathleen and I, Michael left it to the two of us to discover the canister. And that's all Kathleen had to hear before bolting ahead of us in the final stretch. And then we heard her distant exclamation of discovery.
Oh, we're lost!
And about a minute later...
I found it, Michael. Good thing it's orange.
This is so cool. Oh, you better take pictures. Am I going first?
You go first. You found it first.
I found it first.
Kathleen and I proudly signed the register, and then it was Michael's turn. And since he's no stranger to this summit, I asked him,
you know, what's it like to hit this summit one more time?
The weather's always different. And I'm delighted just to be here now. Fog, mist, trees, boreal forest, moss green, July 13th, 2025.
More information at Catskill3500club.org. For WJFF Radio Catskill, this is Brett Barry.
You can hear that full episode and all of the great podcast episodes of Cats Cast, the Catskills podcast at catscast.com. That's spelled KAATSCAST.com. That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, the Lou Beach Community House is inviting you to a summer jubilee celebrating Radio Catskill's 35th anniversary this Saturday from 5 to 8. Live music from Lally and the Pops, Calison, and a DJ set from Jason Tuga. That is coming up Saturday. Tickets are $25 and all proceeds benefit Radio Catskill. And thanks to the Beaverkill Valley Land Trust and Lou Beach Community House for supporting Radio Catskill. And thank you for listening. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support comes from Catskills Property Care, offering full property care year-round for commercial and residential properties in Sullivan County, including snow plowing, landscaping, property checkups, and more. Information at CatskillsPropertyCare.com. And from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new film releases, live music, and more. CalicoonTheater.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
On the next Radio Lab,
you are going to die from this disease. The chemotherapy is going to stop working.
A doctor cures his own incurable disease.
That was when everything changed. Everything in me shifted.
And wants to use AI to cure all the rest of them.
I just feel this sense of responsibility that, like, you sure as hell better spend the rest of your time trying to find as many more of these medicines to help other people.
That's on the next Radio Lab. Wednesday at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. We're streaming live at WJFFradio.org. Nice weather continues today. Plenty of sunshine, a high of 68. clear, low 46. And the mild sunny conditions continue through the weekend into Saturday, with temperatures in the low 70s to mid 70s on Thursday. Looks like a shower in the afternoon possible on Sunday. Otherwise, nice with some clouds and sun mixed. Enjoy it. On Point, it's coming up next.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.